Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jeff Currier, and he'll be answering your most important questions on St. Brandon's Atoll. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Jeff Currier about St. Brandon's Atoll. Looking for that shot at a permit? Whipray Key Fishing Lodge in Belize is where you want to be. When you stay at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge, you're on a private island and are only minutes away from some of the finest permit fishing in Belize. Whipray Key is just a 30-minute boat ride from Placentia. Once you're there, you'll be fishing Permit Alley, one of Belize's best fisheries, and you won't be taking long boat rides to get started. You'll fish with world-class guides like Daniel Cabral, whose family has fished the area for over 30 years. Want to switch it up and fish for tarpon and bonefish and make it a grand slam? They can make it happen at Whipray Key Fishing Lodge. Book your next adventure now. Visit WhipraykeyFishingLodge.com. That's Whipray and then C-A-Y-E, fishinglodge.com. Before we introduce Jeff, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Jeff's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a one-year subscription to The Drake Magazine, courtesy of The Drake Magazine. Who else? And The Drake Magazine is a grassroots journal for fly fishing enthusiasts, no matter where you live. It has stories and photos that will entertain you for hours. So if you don't win this tonight, check them out at drakemag.com. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question or questions. It might be a two-part question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something we talk about during the show, and you just submit your answer along with your name and your location in that text box on our homepage. So listen closely and take notes and see if you can't win that one-year subscription to Drake Magazine. Our guest tonight is Jeff Currier. Jeff is a fishing ambassador for Yellow Dog Fly Fishing Adventures, hosting exotic trips and exploring new destinations. Jeff is a fly fishing lecturer and well-known fish artist. He has taught the skills of fly fishing, guided by fly fishers throughout Wyoming and Yellowstone National Park, and escorted fly fishers throughout six continents for many of the world's greatest game fish. Jeff has appeared on several television shows, including Fishing the West, Fly Fishing the World in Search of Fly Water, Real Adventures, Fly Fish TV, and Fly Fish America. Jeff is also a featured angler in popular fishing movies, including Turning Points North, Carpland, Waypoints, Connect, and Soulfish 2. Jeff's articles and photographs and artwork have graced the pages of magazines and catalogs, brochures, and books. Jeff is the acclaimed author of Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Saltwater Fly Fishing and Currier's Quick and Easy Guide to Warmwater Fly Fishing guidebooks. When not fishing or writing, Jeff is usually found working on one of his favorite hobbies, painting fish. His fish art decorates T-shirts, fly reels, coffee mugs, books, magazines, and his original watercolors are always in high demand. Although Jeff spends much of his time fly fishing for trout, he is a walking encyclopedia of fly fishing for species worldwide. He's constantly traveling and developing techniques for catching the most exotic fish imaginable in places where even the most avid adventurer refuses to go. This IGFA world record holder and National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame record holder has fished in over 55 countries and caught over 380 species of fish on the fly. But not fishing, Jeff can be found lecturing throughout the U.S. and Canada on nearly every aspect of fly fishing. He demonstrates fly casting techniques. Fly casting teaches seminars on the basics to the advanced skills of fly fishing and presents many fly fishing destination programs ranging from his home waters in the Rockies to the most remote corners of the globe. Well, Jeff, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio for your 8th interview. Pretty astounding.
Thank you, Roger. It's good to be back. Always good
yeah.
to do this.
Well, you, I like it, you like it, and our audience likes it, and so I think we have a winning solution there. So, well, you've been off on many other adventures since we last talked, but one you've been to twice in the past couple of years is St. Brandon's Atoll. So let's just chat about where is St. Brandon's Atoll.
St. Brandon's Atoll is pretty much the other side of the planet. In fact, it's our antipode. If I drilled a hole through the center of the Earth from Victor, Idaho, I'd pop up within about 100 miles of St. Brandon's Atoll. So to get there, we fly to Europe. In fact, both times I've been, I went via Paris once and via London this year. So that's a long way. We all know that. Well, guess what? Then it's another 12.5-hour flight from there to Port Louis, Mauritius. And that's about 2.5 days, really, to get that far. And then we have a 26 to 30-hour boat ride 268 miles northeast of the country, the island country of Mauritius, and then you're at St. Brandon's Atoll. So it's, seriously, it's a good 3.5 to 4 days from my house to my cabin at St. Brandon's Atoll.
Wow. So, and it's in the Indian Ocean?
Yes, it is. So if I think most people know where Africa is, and just east of Africa, down near the bottom of Africa, you have Madagascar, which is the largest island, I think, in the world, out there in the Indian Ocean. And then it's another 600 miles past that. You'll see a little tiny island nation called Mauritius, and that gets you pretty close to where we're at.
So St. Brandon's is part of the country it belongs to is Mauritius.
That's right.
Yeah. Do you need a visa to go to Mauritius?
No, it's pretty simple. It's like going to Belize. They give you the visa on the plane just before you land, and you fill it out, and you're in. It's pretty easy to get in and out.
Okay. So Mauritius is what? Is that a collection of islands, basically?
I think there's two main ones, and we fly into the one that has the capital city, Port Louis. But I think there's another island maybe a couple hundred miles away and maybe a couple smaller ones. But St. Brandon's is a group of islands. So it's an atoll, probably about 40 to 60 miles long, and there are over 50 little islands there. Now, only a couple of them are big enough to really, you know, like we have one. Our island is called St. Raphael, and that's where we have a cabin and where we stay at night, and the guides are there. And there's actually about 20 locals that live there year-round. They're actually fishermen, lobster fishermen and true fishermen. But there's one other island out there that has a few local fishermen on there as well.
Wow, okay. And is there just the one island that's occupied, or are there several of the islands in the atoll that are occupied?
I would say there's two of them. So ours is probably the biggest colony. And, again, we're talking like 20 people that are there. But I have seen there's one island. We actually do a lot of permit fishing near one of the islands. It's about maybe 20 miles from the lodge. And that has a few local fishermen up there and almost like tents and stuff. So I think they go in there temporarily to do their fishing, and then they're out of there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Zeno in Los Alamitos, California, he asks, how was the 26-hour ride from Mauritius to St. Brandon's? Were you confident in the boats used to trek?
Yeah. Well, the first part of his question, I'll answer that. It's boring because it's, we do it on a 53-foot or 54-foot sport fisher, which is it's a pretty darn big boat. But, you know, you just really have nothing to do. The first time I went, which was in 2017, I was like, oh, this boat ride is not going to bother me. I'll bring my computer. I got a lot of writing projects and, you know, photo editing that I'll do. Well, you can't because the boat bounces. Even when the seas are not rough, it's just it's open ocean, open Indian Ocean. So the boat's going up and down. You're rolling, so it's really hard to do anything. So for me, the hardest part is the boredom. And other than that, no, the ride is not bad at all. It goes very quickly. Some of the guys that were on the trip with me, in fact, both trips I've been on, they take a sleeping pill or they take some seasick type stuff, and they sleep almost the whole darn time. It's probably next time I go, I'm going to look at it as an opportunity to catch up on lost sleep.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's, I was wondering, even a boat that big, is that, I guess it's safe enough in high seas as well, huh, or marginal? What would you think?
Yeah, they can handle 5-meter swells, which is, you know, that's pretty darn big swells. Both my trips, so two trips out and two trips back. The first trip out, the second trip out, the first trip back, we had nothing bigger than about 2-meter swells, which is nothing. It's beautiful. This last trip coming back, we had 3.5s, almost 4s, and it was a little gnarly. I actually went to my cabin about 6 hours into the trip and climbed in my bunk bed, and I stayed there most of the rest of the trip, which is, yeah, I slept, you know, took an Ambien, which may not be for everybody, but for me, it worked out good, and, you know, I passed 20 hours on the way back. As far as safety, you know, at the end of his question, yes, I do feel safe. The captains are superb. Really, you know, I talk to everybody when I'm on these trips, and it's always fun meeting these guys and getting their life history, but they're very experienced. Our captain on this last trip, he had done the crossing 72 times, so he knows what he's doing. And we also have two boats, so the place takes 8 anglers, and you always have a guide on each boat going back, so we have 2 boats with 4 anglers and a guide. It's kind of nice having the 2 boats, because if there was a problem with one boat, and God knows it could happen, I don't think they've had a problem, but it could happen, we could all climb on the other boat and probably still head to the destination, or if we're heading back, head back and be fine.
Yeah, yeah. Roy Fukushima in Orange, California asks, I really enjoy hearing about your adventurous global fly fishing expeditions and have some of your fish artworks, especially like the bonefish mugs. What are the accommodations, and are there plenty of fly guides available? So you said you're bringing one guide per 4 fly fishers, right?
No, it's actually one guide. So when you're actually getting guided, it's one guide per 2 anglers. So 2 of the guys stay on the island. They take turns escorting the clients back and forth from Mauritius to St. Brandon. So when you get out there, the way the accommodation is, you got San Rafael Island, which is, you know, it's a small island, but at night I fish my way around it every night, and it takes me about 2 hours to fish my way around. I usually get back at sunset just in time for dinner. But we have like a little, you know, bed and breakfast type place out there, very simple accommodations, but very clean and nice. So there's 4 rooms, 2 people to a room. There's a shared bathroom, so there's 2 bathrooms for 8 people. And the eating is right there. We have our own little kitchen, so we can get up early in the morning and make coffee before breakfast is served. And then they do serve breakfast, and then at night you come in from fishing, and they have hors d'oeuvres, which a lot of time for us is sashimi, you know, because there's a lot of yellowfin tuna around the island, and the locals go out and get them for us. And then we have a nice dinner, and that's quite often seafood, because it's some of the best seafood you could ever ask for. That's all they have out there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sounds good. So, air conditioning or not needed?
We do have air conditioning. Every room has a fan and an air conditioning. And I don't think we used our air conditioning at all this last trip. It actually gets, you know, in the evening gets down about 75 degrees, which is, for me, very comfortable. Usually just the fan will do it for me. But some people, you know, they love their air conditioning. They'll turn it on the second they get in from fishing and leave it on until the next morning. I like to kind of get used to the climate I'm in, because I hate walking out of a room all cool and comfortable, and then you get hit with that 95-degree weather, and then you become kind of sluggish when you're on the flats.
Yeah, just get slammed, yeah. We just got a question in on the Internet from Captain Joyce Rear, probably didn't pronounce it right, but Sanibel Island down in Florida. And she asks, what's the prime time of year for permit down there?
Well, the best, their season is September to December, and then April till June. And I've only been in April and May, and my April trip last year was one of their slower permit weeks ever. This year, when I actually had some success, and I'm sure we'll get to that, they considered it a pretty good week. But hands down, I think their best fishing is in for a permit is September and October.
Okay. Okay. All right. Roy Fukushima asks, what is the detailed cost of a trip like this from the USA?
Well, the way you book it is through Yellow Dog, and the price, I believe, is $8,500. At worst, $9,000, but I think it's $8,500. And it doesn't matter whether you book with Yellow Dog. It's kind of cool because, you know, you book through Yellow Dog another place, but you're paying the same price you would if you went direct to the place. And that's the nice thing about, you know, booking with Yellow Dog. You send your money to Montana, not to Africa or to some island out in the Indian Ocean. People are a lot more comfortable doing that. And usually on a trip like this, you'll have to put down a 50% deposit when you book it. And that says you're going, and then usually about 2 months before a trip is when you have to pay the final amount. And that $8,500 covers pretty much from Port Louis when you get there to going out to the lodge, your guides, your fishing all week, and then back to Port Louis. You do have to buy your hotel at Port Louis on both ends, and you have to tip the guides. And typical tipping, I would say, you know, if there's two guys at a boat with a guide, that guide's probably going to end up getting about, you know, $75 to $100 from each client. So you got to budget that in, and we always pay in U.S. dollars.
Per
client. Guides, by the way, I'll say are superb. Yeah, per client. The guides are really, really good. They're all good friends of mine, but they're impressive.
Yeah, yeah. And then what about airfare and other transportation to get to that point?
Well, the airfare, you know, that is, I usually start, if I commit to a trip, I look at the airfare that day just to see where it's at, you know, so it's in my head that, you know, okay, this is what I saw. Now I'm going to try and beat that in the next couple months. And my trip last year, I paid $2,100, which is a lot. You know, anytime you get up over $1,800, you better be going a long way, and of course you are going a long way. And I'm also leaving from Jacksonville, Wyoming, which is always expensive, too. This year, I got a better deal. I got it for $1,800. So you just never know.
Yeah, depends on where you're coming from. And you know, a lot of times you get flights cheaper out of, like, for instance, New York City or something where there's a lot of flights going east.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, and then so that 26-hour boat ride was included in the – and the $8,500 as well, right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, okay. Scott Nelson asked about what travel credit cards do you use. And I don't know what he's after there, but whether he's after, you know, which ones give you the best mileage, you know, points and so forth, or which ones are accepted.
I'll give you my whole rundown. First, I think what he's asking is, you know, what card will work over there? Because I will be honest with you, in a lot of countries, in Africa particularly, American Express does not get you very far. You know, maybe in the capital city when you get off the airplane in the airports, it works. But a lot of businesses, once you get into rural areas, you got to have a Visa card. So I bring my Visa card when I go far away from home. And but I'm not a Visa guy. I usually use my Delta Sky Miles card because it gets me miles with Delta, and I fly almost exclusively with Delta.
Okay. Okay, good. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back. We'll start talking about some equipment and so forth, and what you brought, what you used, that kind of thing. So hang tight with me, Jeff, here, and we'll be right back. Watermaster is dedicated to providing their customers with the highest quality inflatables on the market, as well as an unbeatable customer service and product support. They are best known for their signature products, the Watermaster Grizzly and Kodiak rafts. These rafts are lightweight, compact, durable, versatile, and safe. The Watermaster rafts are everything your personal watercraft should be. They have been used by anglers and hunters all over the world for over 15 years, including Dave Whitlock, one of fly fishing's greatest innovators. Dave said, with my Watermaster, I can enjoy more fishing per hour than any other method I have ever tried. After 2.5 years of testing 15 models of kick boats, I am convinced that Watermaster is the ultimate personal flotation craft for warm and cold water fly fishing. Visit Watermaster today and take a look at the ultimate personal flotation craft. Go to BigSkyInflatables.com. Again, that's BigSkyInflatables.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jeff Currier about St. Brandon's Atoll. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Jeff, I always ask my guests what's going on in your fly fishing world. I know travel is a big part of it. Anything else you got happening here in the next few months?
Oh, yeah. I'll be in Costa Rica in about 8 days, going down with one of my best friends. We're going to try and get a blue marlin on fly. People that follow the blog have probably seen some of my marlin excursion. I don't have a lot of good luck with marlin, but every once in a while, someone will come out of the woodwork from somewhere down in Central or South America, and they'll promise me my marlin. So we'll see what happens. See if we can break the marlin curse, and that'll be a good trip. And then this fall, I've got quite a few things, but most of it's pretty close until December. The one that I'm really excited about is I'm heading to Anna Atoll, which is we're flying to Tahiti, and from there, I think it's another 200-mile small plane flight to get to some crazy atoll. I actually haven't had much chance to research. I'm going with a few friends that say they have it dialed and asked me if I wanted to go, and you know what my answer would be? Yes,
sure.
I'll be there.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I have a friend who actually sailed around the world, and when they were in the South Pacific, because of their sailboat, they went to some of these atolls, islands, and so forth that were kind of off the beaten track, and they said it was just incredible the amount of fish that were out there, just getting away from, like, the tourist areas. I guess it's just incredible. So hopefully you have a great time down there. All right, what's your website address, Jeff, so in case people want to find out about your adventures, your blog, your artwork, all that stuff? Where do they go?
Well, my blog's built right into my website, and my website is jeffcurrier.com, so that's easy. You just have to spell my last name right, which is C-U-R-R-I-E-R.
And, there you go. Okay.
I come up pretty easy. If you type in a weird fish on Google, you're probably going to end up on one of my blogs anyway. So.
Yeah. So jeffcurrier.com, folks, if you want to check Jeff's blog out. He writes actively about all his fly fishing adventures, so you can really get a good feel of what's happening on the trip. So check it out. We're going down there to fish a bunch of different species. We'll talk about that in a minute. But so what's your arsenal that you're taking down there in the way of rods? What size, weight rods are you taking down?
You know, St. Brandon's a little easier than a lot of destinations because, and I know we're going to talk about species, there's not as many different species as you find, say, in like the Seychelles or down in Belize, so you can narrow it down a little bit. And the focus species are really bonefish, permit, and then a few different types of smaller trevally, and then the big guys. So what I brought this year, I brought 1/8 weight, which is kind of my bonefish rod. I always have like a crazy Charlie or a gotcha on that rod. And when I see a big bonefish, it's going. But I brought 2 9-weights and 2 12-weights because those are my bread and butter rods. I use 9-weights for big bonefish, and I use 9-weights when I'm fishing permit. And this year, in fact, both years, really, I had my heart set on catching a yellow permit. So those 9-weights were both rigged in the boat at all times. And even though you wait in the flats, we always have the boat there to hold our gear. And I brought 2 12-weights also because there are some big, giant trevally there, and I mean really big. Seychelles, you get more giant trevally, but they're in that, they measure those guys by centimeters, and typically they're 80 to 110 centimeters. A lot of the trevally, the giant trevally they've caught in St. Brandon's, and they don't catch many, but they're huge, and they almost are always over 100 centimeters. I think they got a fish that was 130 centimeters this year. So those 12-weights are for those guys, the only way you're going to get them.
So are you bringing the extra rods as backups, or I suppose backups as well as rigging them differently? so you can grab
them. Yeah, yep, they're backups also. So, like, I mentioned five rods there, but I probably didn't bring five reels. I actually brought a reel for the 8-weight, one reel for the 12-weight, so that extra rod was a backup if I broke it on a GT, which certainly can happen. So the only rod that I really brought two reels for was the 9-weight rigs.
And that was mainly because you were focused on the permit and you wanted to be rigged up differently, or?
Yeah, I just thought, sometimes those fish come into you so quickly that you show your fly to them three or four times and they don't eat it, and you want to make a quick change. But if anybody's ever tried to change a fly when you got a big permit in front of you, it can be a little nerve-wracking, and the hands shake and the eyes aren't as good as they used to be. So it's really nice to just pick up that other rod with the other crab on it and try it right away. And essentially, that extra 9-weight becomes a backup for me, too. If I break my 9-weight, I've got that extra 9-weight.
Yeah. And rods can break so easily for many different reasons. But so, and then what type of line did you bring down? Were you consistent across all three rods, particular brand, particular type?
Pretty close. So it's flats fishing, so 90%, in fact, 99% of my fishing on flats where I'm wading, and it's weightable flats, I should make that clear, is floating line. So my favorite line for like my 8 and my 9-weight would be the Scientific Angler's Amplitude Grand Slam lines. It's just a great line for making short, powerful cast to, say, a quick-moving target, which would be a permit. A lot of times they come into your zone, they're out of your zone so quick, and you're walking along and you just have 8 feet of fly line on the tip of the rod, but you got to make a 60-foot cast. So you need to be able to do that in less than four false casts. If you can do it in two, that's the best. And that line helps you do that because of that short head. But on the 12-weight, I don't particularly like that line for fishing giant trevally because, I'm throwing a bigger fly and I'm also going to be yanking on that fish so hard. Those big trevally, if you hook them and you don't put an unbelievable amount of pressure on them, they will take you to coral, they will take you to some snag, or they'll get so far away, so deep in your backing, you'll have no chance. So kind of the new way of fighting them these days is they take the fly and you try not to let them have any line at all, which is impossible. But with the drag completely cranked up on my bower reel, a big GT will make it about 100 feet at the most, and then he stops. Now, I'm going to go with him. I've been pulled off the beach before, and I've been pulled, almost out to sea a couple times. But, when you're putting that much pressure on a fish, you've got obviously you're cheating a little bit in your leader. We use straight 150-pound test, and we need a fly line that's not going to break. And most fly lines are 30 to 40, even maybe some are 50-pound test strength. The line I use is the Scientific Angler's Big Water Taper, which is 100-pound core, so it's almost impossible to break that line. And you can fight those fish and land them in, 15 minutes or less. I've seen some South Africans land those fish in, 8 minutes. It's incredible.
Mm. Now, is that
scary.
Pardon me?
I said it's scary.
scary. Okay. Is that a line you would use for large tarpon as well?
Yeah, I think quite a few people are going to like to use it for tarpon because that technique is also of fighting fish is being used in tarpon as well. Where I saw it the first time really used was I was in Gabon a couple of years ago, which is a country on the western side of Africa, and I was there to catch a fish called the threadfin. But most of the South African guys I was with who had became great friends, we had such a good time, they were all there to land a tarpon off the beach, and I watched a 200-pounder get landed by Arno van der Nest, and it was a sight to behold. And thank God for the super strong line, or he wouldn't have been able to do it. But he had it, and it worked, and we got that fish in probably about 20 minutes.
So when you're finding big fish like that, what's the technique? Is it the down and dirty, keeping the rod low, and like you said, drag, just crank down?
The drag is it's cranked down, and you almost can't hold your rod, up in the air and put a bend in it. When a fish is pulling that hard, he's going to pull you towards him and get the rod down. So you're almost pointing straight at the fish, but, of course, that's probably not a good thing either. So I kind of, lift my wrist a little bit and kind of put a bend. It just explains it, but I put a bend in the butt section of my rod. And so I'm almost pointing at the fish, but there's a little bit of an arc way down low in the rod, and that's just enough to, you know, keep you from even breaking a heavy tippet. I mean, a 100-pound tippet can still break on one of these fish. They're so amazing. They shake their head so fast and so violently, they can break anything. But that little bit of bend to the rod helps absorb that and helps you turn the fish. I think most people know I'm a Winston guy, and those rods do have a little flex all the way down to the cork, which I like a lot.
What, how did you, what about your terminal tackle? You just mentioned 100-pound tippet for, is that what you normally use for the big trevallies?
Yeah, so for GTs, I'm using straight 150-pound test, about a 6-foot leader. And I have both those fly lines you buy, they come with a loop already built into them. And I used to cut the loops off and replace them with my own loop. But I actually had a great opportunity to go to the Scientific Anglers factory a couple of years ago and test loops on their machine and see how they're made. And now I use the loops right that come right with the fly line. And I need some wood here. I haven't had one break on me yet. And that says a lot for it. So 150-pound test, loop to loop to my fly line, 6 feet, and then I do a loop knot, and I like the non-slip mono loop to my fly and ready to go. That's not how I fish permit stuff. In the smaller flats fish, that's really just for giant, crazy fish that have to be landed before they get in the coral.
So then talk about the same kind of terminal setup you use for bonefish and permit.
Okay, for those guys, usually get a pre-made fluorocarbon leader. And, again, I'm a Scientific Angler's guy. And for a permit, I usually do 20-pound tests. So I'll do a 12-foot leader for 20-pound. And sometimes I'll cut it back a little shorter, and it probably, realistically, it's probably like 22-pound test. But if I get refusals, and I noticed the first permit caught on our trip was caught by one of the owners of the atoll fishing operation there, Ryan Hammond, and I was asking him a million questions, you know, okay, what to do, what we're using. He was using 16-pound test. And so I dropped the next day. I actually took a 9-foot 20-pound fluorocarbon leader and added 3 feet of 16-pound test to it. And on the third day, I got my first yellow permit. So they're definitely a little tippet shy, even though that place gets no pressure at all.
Yeah.
They're just big eyes, smart. They can see some foul play.
Yeah, those permit are a different animal, aren't they? All the way
there
around.
They are.
Yeah. And then what about bonefish?
Bonefish, I use the same leader. The bonefish seem to be a little less selective, and realistically, I'm probably always fishing that 12-foot, 20-pound tippet. The bonefish, by the way, and I know we're going to talk again, are huge there, so that really helps to have that heavy tippet.
Yeah. Ari in Newbury Park wrote in. He was asking about how many rods, reels, fly boxes you brought. So we've already talked about rods and reels. What do you bring in the way of fly boxes and flies? And he also asks, do you travel with and how do you get them through the airports?
Okay. My flies, my rods, my reels all go as checked baggage. Two reasons. Number one, if you're going through a European airport, a lot of times, particularly in Paris and Amsterdam, you'll have to go through security again. So you enter Europe, you get your passport stamped, and then you kind of have to go through another system there. And they do not like fly rods. I don't know what it is. They have to see them, but I was going to Egypt Nile perch fishing a few years ago, and I actually missed my flight because Air France sent me all the way out of the airport to recheck in and check my rods through. And that's all it took one time to have to miss my flight to Cairo and then in the middle of the night take another flight to Cairo. My buddies were all happy and nestled in their hotels, and I'm getting off the plane at 3 in the morning in Cairo, which is not a nice thing to do. So now I check all that stuff. And knock on wood, you know, I've had good luck with my flights. My stuff 99% of the time makes it there. Back to his question about what I bring. So one of the things people often do on saltwater trips, especially first-timers, is they bring too many flies. You're not going to use a ton of flies because your guide's going to say that's the one that works and that's what we're going to use. And especially permit fishing, where you don't hook that many fish on a trip, you may not hook any. You're really going to go through maybe 4 or 5 flies the whole time. Now, good bone fishing, that might be a little different. You might need you know, 18 flies the whole trip. But what I always tell my clients is bring a big box with all your flies in it. So I bring a Cliff Bugger Beast Junior, not the Beast, the Junior. And it's pretty loaded. And that box will never see the salt water. It will never leave my room. Because once those flies go in the salt, even the salt air, a lot of times those flies, when you get home, will start to rust. So those stay in my room, and then I feed off those. So I have two small boxes that I bring with me on the flats. And every night I reload it with fresh flies if needed.
And the flies that you take off your line don't go back in the box, right?
They do not go back in the box. I have like a little contraption that a buddy of mine gave me. And I just throw the fly in that, and when I get home at night, I put them in the sink and just rinse them off, and then I dry them. And amazing, even though it's super warm in these tropical places, stuff does not dry very well. So keep it in your air-conditioned room that night or put it in front of the fan to get it dry, and then the next day I'll take it back out there. Usually they fluff back up nice. And saltwater flies are expensive. I'm not a very good fly tyer, so I do try to take care of my flies very carefully.
Yeah. Ari also asked about extra insurance for your gear. Do you carry any extra insurance besides what the airline offers?
I do not, but remember, I'm probably a little different human being. I'm probably not paying for the equipment like other people are.
Okay.
That's the honest answer. I'm sticking to it. But I've had very good luck. You know, and I think everybody knows we've all had bad luck once or twice. And then when you fight with him, you never win anyway. So I don't know if I'd pay the extra.
Yeah. Well, an interesting thing happened to me when I went to Belize this year. And I learned from this this experience. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to handle it next time. But checked all my baggage to Belize City. And then, you have to take a small plane down to wherever you're going in Belize from there. We were going to Placencia. So then I see that... as I'm sitting on the plane and they're loading the baggage, that they start loading the baggage, and then some of the bags did not get on the plane. They take them away. Mm-hmm. Well, one of them was my fly fishing gear bag. And
brutal.
So then I get down to Placencia, and then within a half an hour, I'm on a boat out to an island without my gear. And so that was a bit disconcerting. It came the next day and then was brought out by my guide. But it was like evidently on the small planes, as soon as they reach a weight limit, then they don't take any more bags. So half your bags can go and half of them cannot, may not go. So has that ever happened to you? Or how do you handle something that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've definitely been a few places where my stuff didn't make it. On a trip, usually a trip that's organized, say you went on a Yellow Dog trip, or, one of my hosted trips with Yellow Dog, I'm going to have stuff for you, So if your stuff doesn't make it, you're going to be brokenhearted to be wearing my shorts instead of your own, I'm sure. But, we're going to get it worked out. That's a nice thing about being in a big group trip.
Right.
The other thing I do, so a lot of times, like, if I really am going somewhere and it's just me and Granny, my wife or something, and we're going a long way, I split everything. So I mentioned my rods. I had an 8-weight, 2-9s, 2-12s. Well, I've got two bags, and there's going to be 1 9-weight and 1 12 in each one. So if one bag doesn't make it, at least I have a good chance that, one of the bags will make it, and I'll have what I need at least for the first few days until my luggage actually gets there. So, and I'll do that with flies, too. So I'll have my big master box of flies in one bag, and then I put my two small boxes, which are pretty well stocked for the first few days of fishing anyway, in the other bag. And I'm very careful about that. I split my clothes. I split everything right down the middle. My salt offerings, when I got to St. Brands, they're like, geez, Curry, you got so much gear. Why do you need so much gear? I said, well, I'm coming a long way, and if something doesn't make it, that's why I have two bags. And the one, one bag, I never even had to open the whole trip because they both made it, but it was a backup.
Okay, one other question here, talking about gear, and then we'll get into fish and fishing. You said that you're fishing with a boat, so you've got a boat handler, and I take it, a guide and a boat handler when you're out. Is that how it works?
Yes. Yep, the
and
guides.
Then,
are South Africans, so they're all, you know, very good English-speaking guides, and they have a ton of experience. They're all captains. Most of them grew up in the salt water their whole life. And you're going in a boat, not a real fancy flats boat like you would fish, say, if you went to Turner Flats in Belize. You're in basically a boat that's transporting you from flat to flat. So 90% okay. of the fishing, in fact, really 95% of the fishing is actually done on foot. You need a really good quality pair of flats booties for this trip because there's a lot of, you know, coral, and there's dangerous snails you can step on and, you know, all kinds of things you don't want to get hurt and ruin your trip on.
Mm-hmm. So they're holding your excess gear, but what do you take and your extra rods, I take it, or are you carrying an extra rod with you? And what do you have a backpack? How are you rigged up?
Yep.
Flat.
Yep, I have. If we're going to do an epic walk, which usually, you know, you're always going to discuss what you're going to do the night before with your guide, and they're going to give an option like, hey guys, we can go here. We haven't been here in 3 weeks. It's going to be a long walk to hit the tides just right. We're going to have to walk. You know, it's going to be a 6 mile walk, and we're going to start walking at 9 a.m. and we're going to not be done until 3 p.m. So you need to have your big pack with you because we're not going to get back to the boat. They're going to go back and get the boat and meet you at the end, but you know, you're going to be actually out there walking for 6 hours. So I bring the Sims dry pack. I can fit my camera in there. I can fit a bottle of water. I can fit a few snacks. Usually the guide will carry your lunch for you. But I have everything I need, including always a rain jacket, by the way. We get a lot of rainstorms down in St. Brandon's. But if we're just going to go out and hit a perfect tide for like 2-3 hours and go back to the boat, then I use a fanny pack, you know, just a hip pack, and just bring those 2 fly boxes, maybe even just one of those fly boxes, a couple spools of tippet in my shorts, and ready to go. Keep it real lightweight.
Okay, good. All right, we'll be right back, folks. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll get into some fishing techniques and fish and all the exciting stuff. So hang with us just a few minutes. Baja Fly Fishing Company is dedicated to fulfilling your vacation dreams, and just so there's no mistake, they derive as much pleasure from helping a novice improve as they do fishing with a pro. From the casual to the hardcore, they can match your expectations with their experience and coaching. A vacation with Baja Fly Fishing is more than a fishing trip. It's a full-on Baja experience that you will remember forever. They know the Baja after 40 years of traveling its back roads, kayaking its shoreline, surfing and snorkeling, while pioneering the fly fishing techniques that have evolved in the tactics used today. They are well-versed in fly fishing the beach, in kayaks, on pongas, and are well-versed in all tackle types. Join them in pursuit of roosterfish, dorado, marlin, sailfish, wahoo, jack crevalle, yellowfin, skipjack, and many other species. Learn more about Baja Fly Fishing Company by visiting their website at bajaflyfish.com. Again, it's bajaflyfish.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jeff Curry about St. Brandon's Atoll. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box on our homepage to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so, Jeff, let's talk about the species that are available. You mentioned a few of them. What are the top targets you have at St. Brandon's?
Okay, so the main reason people go to St. Brandon's are three different fish. Bonefish, but not just regular bonefish. St. Brandon's has some of the biggest bonefish in the world. You will see a fish over 8 pounds every single day. You're probably going to see a fish over 10 pounds every single day. And there's numerous ones. I think it's the best bone fishing I've ever experienced. You never go very far without at least having an opportunity to fish 2 8-bone fish, and their average size is 5 to 6 pounds. The other fish that people go specifically for is the yellow permit, better known as the Indo-Pacific permit. And its real name is actually the snub-nosed pompano, but of course that's not quite the most glamorous name. People probably wouldn't travel halfway around the world if they didn't realize the snub-nosed pompano was a yellow permit. And then there's the giant trevally, which we talked a little bit about. And there's actually a lot of different species of trevally there, which are great fun. They have the bluefin trevally, they have the island trevally, which is actually the yellow dot, and they have the brassy trevally, which is actually the green spot. And they have the golden trevally. And if people go to my blog, you'll see pictures of every one of those species. And in particular, that yellow dot is a fish that I didn't catch until my first trip in 2017 to St. Brandon's. And it is it's a stunning, stunning looking trevally. Just a fantastic fish to catch.
Cool. And the one you were most interested in going there were the bonefish and the perch?
Well, that first year I went in 2017, I just wanted to get as many different species as possible for my list, and I was able to catch, you know, a few of those trevally, like the island trevally, the yellow dot, and the brassy green spot I had never caught before. So I knocked those off. But I also was pretty adamant about getting that yellow permit, and people think that just because you go somewhere, you catch it. Well, in 2017, let's just say it was a long plane ride home because I didn't get my yellow permit. And even though I knew it was the best place to go in the world for them, I didn't get one. Now, this year, it was a different story. I went there exclusively for a yellow permit, and I ended up catching two, and two good ones. So I was super stoked.
And what about the bonefish?
There's incredible bone fishing too. Now, I was so dedicated to getting that big permit or getting a yellow permit that the first few days of this trip, I didn't cast to the bonefish hardly at all. I maybe catch one every couple hours just for a little action, but you have to be dedicated for permit when you're permit fishing. But I will admit, after I caught that permit, I enjoyed the bone fishing of St. Brandon's. And on the same day that I got my first permit, which was the third day, my first yellow permit, I got an 11-pound bonefish, which was my first bonefish over 10 pounds. So that's probably one of my best days of fishing of my life as far as, you know, accomplishing something I really wanted to do.
Yeah. So your plan for the week was this second trip was to focus on permit until you got that permit.
I wanted him. And, man, it would have been an awful flight home if I didn't get him this time. My South African friends that own the place, they're so good to me. I mean, they're like, okay, Kurt, that's where the permit probably are. We're going to let you in there first. Go have at it. And gave me the fly they thought would work and sent me on my way. A couple times the boys would stay right with me, you know, helping me find the fish. So it was great. Of course, after I caught my first one, that it was all hands on deck. Everybody just kind of went to the best spots. I lucked into another big one on the maybe second to last day, got a really nice fish, almost 14 pounds, which for those yellow permit, that's a big one. They don't seem to get as big as the Atlantics.
Yeah. Roy Fukushima asked another question. He says, describe a typical day on the water. So you've kind of done that in bits and pieces, but I'm getting the impression that sometimes you had a guide standing next to you and other times you're out there solo. So how did that work?
Yeah, well, both my trips, I went as a guest of my South African friends, and they're fishing too. You know, the owners don't get out there more than once every year, some of them even once every couple of years. So we're fishing together. I was, you know, the yellow permit thing was an exception where they're walking, you know, with me to help me get that fish. But a typical trip for your average person is you get up at 6 in the morning and, get your gear together, have a cup of coffee. 7 o'clock is breakfast, and the second you're ready to leave, your guides are ready. So I wolf my breakfast down. I'm done by like 7:05, and I go out, meet my guide, and we head on out to the flats. And we have a pre-plan. So the night before, we'll also, you know, plan a strategy based on tides and what fish we're after. So you might go for a 10-minute boat ride. You might even go shorter than that. Sometimes we started fishing right there from the island based on the tides. Or you may take, you know, if the tides aren't good early in the morning, you'll go for an hour boat ride and then spend the rest of the day fishing your way back to camp. But it's a long day from about 7:15 in the morning till, you know, 4:30 in the afternoon.
Yeah. And you're moving to different water every day pretty much? I mean, is there that much water to fish there?
Yes, they rotate it big time. Yeah, they rotate it among guides and rotate around among the guests. So every guest is going to see every spot at least once. And if one's not fishing well, they'll delete it and go to somewhere else. There's plenty of options for that. And if one is extraordinarily good, then maybe you get to fish that more than once. Even though we like to see new water all the time, if somebody says there's a ton of permit here, Curry, we should probably go there again, I'm going to say, yeah, let's go there again.
Yeah. What's the waiting like there? Sand, coral rubble? What's the general bottom like?
It's everything. It's everything. There's some amazing sand flats where, I mean, you think you could be in a pair of flip-flops, and you probably could, but then all of a sudden you have, a 100-foot stretch where you're crossing some, coral, broken coral and sharp rocks, and then a little turtle grass. It's got everything, but there are a lot of big, beautiful sand flats. Some of our best bone fishing was like sand flats with just little random patches of grass. So the bonefish were super easy to see because they were always crossing those sandy spots. And believe it or not, not knee-deep. A lot of it was like literally halfway between your knee and your ankle, a foot of water at the most. And it was so cool. Like that giant bonefish I got that fish in knee-deep water. And by the way, I've caught a lot of bonefish in the, 7-8 pound range over the years. The difference in fight, a lot of times you get a super huge fish in a certain species, and they don't fight as much because it's like the grandfather. That's the way I've always looked at it. But a bonefish over 10 pounds is an experience that you will not believe. I have not had line ripped from me like that in a long time. And when you get that fish in your hand, an 8-pounder is big, but as soon as you break that 10-pound range, there's so much fish there. I was electrified. I mean, it was like catching my first yellow permit. It was almost the same impact of how cool it was to get that big bonefish.
Yeah. Well, let's keep continuing talking about bonefish first then. Zeno in Los Alamitos, he was asking about the average size. I think you already said that, 6 to 8 pounds.
Average is 5 to 6.
5 to 6. And the largest that you caught was, would you say 11?
11. Yep, yeah. Just under. He's like 10 and 3 quarters.
Were they difficult to catch? What were the challenges?
No. The challenging part is landing them. It seems like a lot of the biggest bonefish we find are kind of right on the edge of the flats and the edge of like dropping into 4 feet of water and a zillion coral heads. So you've got to hold that fish and kind of steer them. You can't just lock up on a bonefish because it'll break you off, especially because you got to use 20-pound test. But you can, using the rod, when you get with the rod, you can kind of, that fish starts running towards the coral, you can steer him a little. You can kind of make him change his mind and go further back on the flat. And one of the things I often do is when the fish is in that situation, once I get him turned and he's going in the flat, I'll ease up on him to let him take off in the middle of the flat, and I'll walk towards him before I put a lot of pressure on him again because I don't want him to get angry and go back to those coral heads again.
Yeah. So that was the challenge, huh?
Battle's the challenge there, but they do take flies very well, not too hard to catch.
And what flies worked best for you there?
A lot of times we're using the crabs, same crabs we use for permit, and they crush them. Those big bonefish in particular love a crab. On my 8-weight, I mentioned I brought 1 8-weight as like my exclusive bonefish rod. On that rod, I added that kind of a tan Crazy Charlie about it. It was a big one too, like a size 4. We used, in Belize, I use very small bonefish flies, like size 8s, Q6s, but over in the Indian Ocean, I'm typically using size 4s.
Okay. And you said most of the time you're fishing for them in sand or turtle grass, that kind of bottom, right?
That's right.
Any different in approach or presentation that you used there that was different from other parts of the world?
Nope, the same old approach, try to, land your fly gently, which quite oftentimes a lot of people don't realize it, especially a really good caster, they do this beautiful double haul and they whip out 80 feet of line, but when that loop is so tight it turns over, sometimes that fly splats on the water really hard, can spook a fish. A lot of times I'll actually ease up. First thing I do is try to get closer than normal, and I might ease up and even do kind of a little bit of a sidearm cast so that fly almost floats and drops gently in front of the fish. But I want to get it close to him. I like to land it, no less than 2 feet away. Usually I'm going to try and land it about a foot away from him and let it sink to bottom and then give it an immediate strip, make it look alive.
Yeah, and you don't have far to sink, it sounds like, with all the shallow water.
No.
Shallow water, huh?
No. Your flies are not too heavy, that's for sure. Your crabs are, but not your bonefish flies in general.
Anything else about the bonefish that you want to mention while we're talking about them?
I'll just say I've seen a lot of bonefish around the world, and I've been a lot of places where, you know, the claim is it's the best bonefishing in the world, and I've seen incredible bonefishing in Belize and the Bahamas, just extraordinary. But this place blows my mind. I mean, it's that good. It's the size of the fish and the amount of fish. It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And not getting the same pressure they get in some of these other parts of the world, I take it, too.
Huh? Yeah, very little pressure. Short season and, you know, only 8 anglers a week for, you know, a couple of months.
Yeah, yeah. Dispersed over a wide area, it sounds like. Yeah. So, okay, let's talk about the permit. Kevin in Wilson, Wyoming, asked what are the important differences between this type of permit and permit in other locations. And then along with that, I got from Captain Joyce here in Sanibel. She wrote in on the Internet, what's the difference, same thing, compared to the Florida permit and the similar type crab patterns we use in Florida, do they work? And then she's talking about, are they tailing or cruising or what's their habits? So maybe you can talk about all that and how these yellow permit are different than the permit we're used to in Atlantic.
First of all, the fish themselves, their behavior is, I think, almost exactly the same. I would say exactly the same, but I'm sure there's some guys that are super pro permit guys and they've noticed something different. But for me, they're super finicky, super smart, super selective. And they fight the same way. They absolutely smoke you and try to get to the coral and break you off. There are differences in the fish themselves, though. The yellow permit versus the Atlantic permit, the yellow permit is a smaller species, at least what we've seen. I know they've got some fish over 20 pounds landed there at St. Brandon's, but, you know, you start following the trails of good Atlantic permit fishing and you see fish 30 to 40 pounds, and then that hasn't been done with the yellow permit. Are you guys still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry, I heard my phone made a funny beep, and I didn't want to make sure it wasn't disconnected.
Nope, still hearing you.
The appearance, good. The appearance of the fish, the shape is exactly the same. Exactly the same. But the black on the Atlantic permit, you don't find on the Indo-Pacific permit, and you don't find the yellow on the Atlantic permit. The Indo permits, which, by the way, the real name of this fish is snub-nosed dart or snub-nosed pompano. I think I mentioned that at the beginning, but in case anybody tuned in. Exact same fish, but it is truly a pompano. But they are very yellow in color. You got to see the pictures of them on my blog. They're so beautiful. It's incredible. But you know why they're yellow, because when you start walking those flats, the grasses and the weeds in the water have the same exact yellow tint about them. When the light hits them, they look the same color as the permit, or the permit look the same color. And they can be very, very hard to see. I think a lot of people have experienced that with Atlantic permit. They're hard to see, even though that black sticks out. That tail is really, they can make it wiggle and move and sway, and it looks like turtle grass, and all of a sudden there's a fish right in front of you, and you blew it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I experienced that down in Belize last time I was down there. The guides see stuff that even when they point it out, I'm still not seeing, you know. It pays to be on the water 300 days a year to see these fish, I'll tell you. I don't know if I read this or where I got this idea. Maybe I'm all wrong, but don't the permit and the Atlantic permit, too, don't they turn color when they get excited or something? Am I off base there, or?
I think something I haven't noticed in permit so much. I mean, definitely there are a lot of species out there, like a Dorado or Mahi-Mahi. Those things light up like crazy, or a Wahoo. I see it a lot in blue water fish, but I haven't really noticed it with permit, but that's not to say that they might brighten up their black, you know, colors or their yellows. I don't know. When I'm seeing those fish on the flats, those yellow permit, before they even see me or have any idea I'm there, they look yellow. They look the same.
They do. Okay.
Yeah, okay. I haven't seen a change.
So, and all the same challenges were there with any other permit, it sounds like. They're just different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. And I'm not a permit guy. I love them, and I've caught my share. In fact, I've done really good this last year. I've had some good luck with the Atlantic permit and good luck with the yellow permit. But I have had my butt handed to me as much as anybody else out there. In fact, it may be worse sometimes. I had a great trip to Belize in December with Will Flack, who's a good buddy of mine, and he's one of the best permit guys I've ever been with. And guess what? 6 days of fishing, we got blanked. We hooked three, landed zero. It was a tough trip.
Oh, yeah.
So
that makes me
they
feel
have my
good,
number
yeah.
many times. I think I made a lot of people feel good. That's why I wanted to tell them that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's really hard to come back from a trip and they say, well, what did you catch? Well, I had some on and a lot got off and, oh, really? And then everybody kind of like gets disinterested, right? I mean, non-fly fishers, right?
They want to see pictures.
Yeah, 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 that's for sure. So what type of water did you find them in? Was it similar to the bonefish, like turtle grass or?
Yeah, you'd find small ones. You might find a 5 to 6 pounder in the exact same shallow stuff that we're talking about for the bonefish, but on average, the perma are going to be a little deeper, so they're almost always going to be in that knee to thigh deep water. And that first one I caught, he was probably right in that, just above the knee, and he was tailing really good, which, by the way, they tail just like the Atlantic permit, so again, very, very similar fish. And there were three of them, and I dropped my fly in front of them, and then typically what happens, all tails go down, and you're hoping they're following your fly, and I had glare, so I couldn't see, but I stripped, and I felt the tug, and I was like, oh, my God, I missed him. And I stripped one more time, and then maybe when another one grabbed it, maybe the same one came and grabbed it. Anyway, I got that fish. But my second permit, what I got in the second to last day, that was a much deeper water. I was waiting for the fish to come on the flat in front of me, and there was a little bit of a drop-off. Maybe it was maybe 4 feet deep going all the way out a long way. And I saw this fish three times, but he never came into the 2 foot of water. He stayed out in that 4 foot, and he was super, super hard to see. So the third time, I just got aggressive, and I threw out my crab, sank at the bottom one strip, and he pulverized it. It was awesome. That never happens to me. Never have permit pulverize a fly, and this fish just destroyed it. I couldn't do anything but hook him. It was great. So lucky.
Do you fish the tide similarly that you do in Belize, and do you have a similar window of time to, when they come up onto the flats, or is it a longer
yes.
or shorter?
It depends on the flat, but, the best flats are usually, it's a short period of time, so we'll know they're going to be there for 2 hours, and then they're gone, so you're trying to get it done in that time. And some of that stuff is way over my head. That's why, you have to have a guide. Because they know. They know.
Yeah. What did you do, again, have my experience last time in Belize is, you have that two-hour frame, and then you're kind of, there's no fish. So what did you do there? Did you go fish for other fish, or is there another flat you can fish that the tide's coming up on? How did you manage your time?
Yep, we can go to usually if one flat is, only good for 2 hours, and then when it starts to taper off, if you know where you're going and know the way the water and the way the tide's reacting, a few miles away, you might be able to go another flat and get another hour. And so, like the days when we might start right next to camp, start fishing, we'd fish that flat till 10 in the morning, and then it starts to taper off, and then we go another 2 miles and catch the last hour at the next flat, and then the last hour, and we can actually kind of scrape out a good 5 to 6 hours of good permit fishing. And when it's completely done, and it, no doubt it is, that's when you just got to change gears. You've got to, I'm going to go bone fishing, or, let's go catch some of the trevally species. Usually the bonefish and the permit are pretty closely related to, their activity being good. So then we would go chase the bluefin trevallies and the yellow dots and just have a great time. I love those things.
Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about trevallies and also that one you put on your bucket list and caught, that Picasso triggerfish, so a little gem of the Indian Ocean, right? So hang with me. We'll be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to all fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with restoration of habitats like Wolf Creek in Idaho, in Sands Creek and Upper Delaware in New York, and funds projects and collects valuable data about fish and their habitats, like the peacock bass study in Miami, Florida. Fly Fishers International core values remain unchanged: to serve as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish, to preserve and to promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying, and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. That's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jeff Currier about St. Brendan's Atoll. If you'd like to ask Jeff a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, so I'm just reading here, Jeff, some of the questions that have come in here. We didn't talk really, let me just finish up with the permit about flies. Crabs, pretty much, anything specific? Flies we know that you use at work?
Yep, I don't go anywhere in the world permit fishing without a merkin crab, and it doesn't matter if it's down in Belize or if it's in the Indian Ocean. That fly flat out works everywhere, and I caught my first permit on this trip on the merkin. But I've been fishing thanks to my friend Will Flack, who owns the Belize Permit Club down there in southern Belize, in Hopkins, Belize. He turned me on to the Bower crab in December, and that's what I caught my second permit on. And I love the way the fly looks in the water. I love the way, I hooked those three fish in December on it. And the best part, though, my African friends were looking at it like, what is that thing Currier's using, which is always fun for me because I'm confident in it, and they weren't, and then I made it work. So that's one of my favorite flies for the permit.
Good.
It's the same.
Okay. Some of the questions came in on the Internet. Lance Tomar in Canyon City, Colorado. Says, the atoll is very big. Did you fish mainly on the lodge end, or did you cover the far reaches of the atoll as well? Seems like it would be a long boat ride.
Yeah, we have the option of doing a 2-hour boat ride and touching up on some of the water that really, rarely gets touched. But 2-hour boat ride is a big chunk out of your day. If you go 2 hours, you're going to have to take 2 hours to get back. We pretty much stay on that side close to the lodge. So an hour boat ride is about as far as we go. There's a few exceptions, One of the guides might have a real good hunch about a permit being somewhere where nobody's been in like 3 weeks or something like that, but an hour or less is typically the boat ride.
Okay. Lance also asked, you didn't say in your blog on St. Brendan's, was there any chance of some offshore dredging, like for Dogtooth?
Yeah, no. Lance has dredged with me in the Seychelles, so I know what he's imagining. Yeah, the dredging in the Seychelles is incredible. The dredging in St. Brendan's is not that good. And a couple of my friends did it on that first trip. And the reason it's not good, they actually have an agreement with these local fishermen. You guys stay off the flats and fish the blue water, and we won't mess with you and you're fishing in the blue water. So their blue water fishing, as far as deep water fishing, for groupers and snappers and, all kinds of crazy wrasses, it's not that great, so we don't do it. You can do it, catch a few fish, but he'd be disappointed after what he saw in the Seychelles. But the migratory fish, like yellowfin tuna, mahis, the billfish, it can be absolutely incredible at St. Brendan's, but they really don't have the boats to go out and do that, with a fly rod.
Okay, all right. Sorry, Lance. let's talk about that Picasso triggerfish, because you seem pretty excited about that on your blog. And so that was one on the bucket list you wanted to catch, too, and you did, right?
Yeah, he was, and one of the reasons, it's a very small fish. You could call it the pumpkin seed of the Indian Ocean. I mean, he's a small, beautiful, colorful fish. Anybody's first trip to the Indian Ocean is probably not going to give a darn about that thing because they want to get into the bigger, better stuff. But I've experienced them. I like fishing triggerfish. There's many good game fish, triggerfish over there in the Indian Ocean to fish for. The Picasso strikes me because I'm an artist, So I just wanted to see these amazing colors in my hand. I've also had a lot of these Picasa triggers eat my fly, and I couldn't hook them because they're so small. Their mouths, you could not fit anything bigger in their mouths, bigger than the tip of your pinky. They're real tiny, and that's why they're hard to hook. But over time, I think my first trip to Sudan was back in 2013. Since then, this fish has gotten some recognition as being a cool fish to catch. So I said, you know what? This is going to be the trip I'm going to knock one off. So I put on a small, crazy Charlie, like a size 8 that I would use in Belize, and I went out and just randomly cast to coral heads in waist-deep water. And I had quite a few chased to fly. I finally hooked and landed one. But I had to dedicate an afternoon to that little tiny fish. I'm glad I did. It was cool. Very rewarding.
So is it kind of like blind casting to these coral heads and just somebody knowing that they're there, like the guides telling you
exactly.
That they're
there? Yeah. Yep. And my own experience, just, and I remember where I saw them a lot in Sudan, and I remember where I've seen them in the Seychelles. I just always was focused on something bigger, better, so I really didn't take the time, because it takes some time, because like I say, they're very difficult to hook that tiny mouth. But there's a lot of them. There's a lot of them around. And,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. God, yes. Many other fish. That's actually another thing that makes catching the Picasso difficult, because they have a fish called the Blue Spangled Emperor, which in the Seychelles, I've seen big Blue Spangled Emperors that are beautiful and fun to catch, great big ones, but I have not seen one bigger than about 12 inches, not even 12 inches in St. Brandon's. And those things, you're casting the coral heads, hooking them every cast, it gets a little frustrating.
Okay, all right. Doug McLean in Calgary, Alberta, asked, he says, what sort of water do you find the Picassos in? What flies and sizes do you recommend? He says they're on his bucket list as well, hoping to find some in Christmas Island.
Yeah, I don't know about Christmas, but they should be there. I would bring, size 8 Crazy Charlies, something that's going to get their attention and be small enough to fit in their mouth, and just fish those coral heads. When you're out there at the ocean flats, they call it, and walking there, that would be a real good place to throw that small fly around and try to find some. You're going to catch some pretty cool stuff, I guarantee it.
Yeah, never know what you're going to get. So let's finish up with Trevally. You had mentioned a lot of different species there of Trevally. What would you say is the most popular one?
Well, no doubt the ones that people are going there for would be the giant Trevally or the bluefin Trevally. And you find bluefin Trevallys in the Seychelles. We catch them all over the Indian Ocean. I've caught them pretty much everywhere that I've ever fished for them. But the ones in St. Brandon's are huge. So, for instance, in the Seychelles, we catch bluefin Trevally up to 8 to 10 pounds. I got a 15-pounder once in Sudan. But in St. Brandon's, you get them 15 to 20 pounds. Just monster bluefin Trevally. The other ones, the island Trevally, the yellow dot, and the green spot, people aren't drawn to catching those, which amazes me, because I think that yellow dot is very similar to the bluefin and just a super sharp-looking fish. Not easy to catch either. The way they come on the flat is they move extremely fast in a big school. They tail for like 3 seconds, and then they move about 100 feet and tail again. So you have to see them way away and kind of be a judge as to where they're going to, where you need to go so that you intercept them, if that makes sense.
Now, are you talking about the Trevally in general or the yellow dot specifically?
That would be the yellow dot. And the one I didn't mention, too, that people do go there, specifically catch is the golden Trevally. It's a beautiful fish. It's, it's one of the most prized Trevally when you go to Christmas Island. To catch a golden is quite an accomplishment. And there's a lot of them at St. Brandon's.
So you had mentioned the yellow dot has this behavior of coming onto the flat, moving fast, feeding quickly. What about the giant Trevally? How do they feed on?
The giant Trevally, usually you're coming in to the flat, on the boat, and imagine you're in like 8 to 10 feet of water, and all of a sudden you see a car door swim by real fast. That's pretty much the way you see the GTs, and then you go into frantic casting, and usually you don't have a lot of luck. But you remember that fish is there, So then you go out, you get dropped off in the island, go out and do your bone fishing and look for a permit. But then you might, you know, walk out in that waist deep water and look for that fish now that he hasn't seen the boat in a while, and try to cast to him. I had a pretty extraordinary experience on my first trip over. I was walking a flat. I don't want to get too long in the story here, but I was walking a flat a long ways, and there were a bunch of small turtles. You know, I say small, they were about the size of, you know, an old record, you know, an album. And I saw a big black shape out off the flats. I ran out of flat, and it went into deep water. And I saw this big shape, and I thought it was a GT, and I got my rod ready. Well, it turned out to be a 12-foot tiger shark, and actually got him to eat my fly. I never felt him, though. I tried to strip set, never felt him. But I don't know what I would have done anyway. But he was out there eating those small turtles. Well, a few days later, I was on that same flat, but there was also like a little peninsula on that flat that went out a ways, and I was looking for permit. But you're out there, so now I was like almost completely surrounded by that deep water, and I saw this huge fish coming. I'm like, oh my God, it's that giant tiger fish coming. I'm going to get my butt out of here. And I started going as quickly back to the main flat, and then I realized that it was actually a giant trevally. And in that situation, it was coming to me. It was the best situation you can have. That fish has not seen a boat, has not seen a person, has no idea that I'm on this flat, and it's probably coming to the flat to feed. And I carried my 12 weight on my, I strap it to my back, and I can make a quick switch. So I just dropped my permit rod, made a long cast so the line was floating, so I'd find my rod and went after this fish with my 12. And he was so big, and he did come, he chased my fly. And when he was coming straight at me, he was like 8 inches across or 12 inches across from eye to eye, looking at my fly, coming full speed. I got so nervous that one of my tricks is I'll just turn my head and just keep on stripping. And I never felt him. And I finally looked up to see what happened, and the fish was right there when my leader hit my rod, but he just didn't eat it.
He didn't take it.
No, but it was. I wrote a good story about it. It was really an amazing experience. I literally got water splashed up over me from this thing putting the brakes on and turning. I don't know what it was. My fly just wasn't right. It was a bummer. They're smart.
Yeah.
They are very, very
Maybe
smart
Maybe it was
animals.
A good thing. Maybe it was a good thing you didn't hook up with him.
But, Roger, I was ready. You know, I said
you were ready
about
for fighting
kind of
a car door, huh?
Yeah, it's kind of terrifying, but I had myself mentally ready. I had my 12-weight rigged. I had that 150-pound test. I had my African friends with me to, you know, coach me. I was ready to put the heat on that thing. So, oh, I look back. I wonder what would have happened. It would have been awesome.
Yeah, yeah. We got one question on the Internet. Rick Wilsterman in Boston wants to know what flies he used for the GTs.
They have flies called brush flies, and they're basically great big, like 5 to 7 inch flies. And we have two colors that we really like. The best way to describe it is we like to have some light ones in our box and some dark ones. So you might have some whitish tan ones, and then you'll have some black or dark purple. You know, a lot of us are going to the purple now for saltwater, and it's really good for tarpon. It's good for all big fish. And my first choice, like if I'm going out there that day and I'm going to rig up my rod and I haven't thrown any trevallies yet, I'm going to have the giant purple one on. And I'll probably make 4 or 5 attempts with that before I go to the lighter color.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We get them on poppers too. I should mention that. We do get them on poppers, but that's more like when you're specifically going on a trevally trip to, say, Christmas Island or to the Seychelles.
So it sounds like definitely you could knock at least one of 3 or 4 kinds of trevally off by going to St. Brandon's if you wanted to focus.
Absolutely.
On yeah.
Yeah, I would say it would be really surprised if you didn't get two or three of those species if you went specifically to fish the different kinds of trevally.
Yeah, cool. Lots to do there, it sounds like. A great place.
Yeah,
we've got a few miscellaneous questions here. More about you and your experience than St. Brandon's, but let me run through these. And Kathy Crossland in Raleigh, he asks, when did you discover the artistic side of your fishing soul and begin drawing? Do you paint from photographs? The details are exquisite, she says.
Oh, thank you. Well, I've always was an artsy guy in school. I did a lot of detentions in high school for drawing on the desk, and I was bored out of my mind with most of the stuff they were trying to teach me. So it's not a good thing, but it's the truth. And luckily, when I was in college, I still did some doodling here and there. And when I wrote my saltwater fly fishing book, one of the great fly fishermen, a lot of us remember, Gary LaFontaine, was a mentor for me when I was writing that book.
Right.
And he knew I did a lot of art, and he said, "Jeff, I want you to illustrate your book yourself." And I did, and I did it all in black and white. And he said, "I love the book. I love the illustrations." He goes, "But I think this book's good enough to do in color." He said, "You need to hire somebody to do some painting for you, because I know you've never worked with color." Well, he knew darn well that I wasn't in a position to hire anybody to do anything. So, and he knew I was going to go home and start teaching myself to paint. So I spent an entire winter working with watercolors. First ones didn't look too good, I can promise you that, but within the end of that winter, I illustrated all the fish in my saltwater book in color, and I look back on it, they don't look that great, but they're kind of cool, because they're my first, and I just stuck with it. I love it. I'm just passionate about painting fish. I'm working on a great big Snake River cutthroat right now that I've been working on for about 4 days, and it's coming along cool. And that probably seems funny to some people, because a Snake River cutthroat, what's so cool about that? You see them all the time. You probably paint a lot of them, and I have, but it is my favorite fish to paint. The colors on the bellies of a Snake River cutthroat, and then all those cool little teeny tiny spots, it's a lot of fun working on them.
I don't know if you answered her question about, do you paint from photographs? Did I miss?
Yes. Yep. No, I didn't say that. I do paint from photographs. So most of the fish I paint, I've caught before, and I always take the best photos I can of any new species I catch. So when it comes time to painting them, I'll have all the things in front of me, from the eye to the fins to the colors.
So basically you were self-taught then? You didn't have any formal...
Yeah, totally self-taught. Totally self-taught. And most fish, most of the trout, most of the basic saltwater and trout and stuff I can paint without even looking at a photo. I've done so many.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, good. Dino in Michigan asks, when considering warm versus cold water in fresh or salt water, what gives the best challenge and reward to you?
Well, I'd say in North American freshwater, I'd have to say a common carp. I mean, these things are really tough to catch on a fly rod. And if you want to become a better fisherman, particularly saltwater flats fisherman, and you live in the middle of the U.S. and don't live anywhere near saltwater, how are you going to practice? Practice on carp. Walk a carp flat and learn how to catch them. It will help you with all your fishing, but especially if you make that trip to St. Brandon's. And they fight like crazy, too, by the way. Holy mackerel.
Yeah, yeah. Dino also writes in and says, okay, crazy number of species caught. What would be your hardest fighting and easiest to catch North American freshwater? But that would be the carp, right? You just described that.
Yeah, I would. And I'll just throw out the hardest freshwater fish I've ever caught in my life is also carp related, and that's the golden moss here over in India.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a freshwater, yeah. Which we did a show on. So, folks, if you want to learn about that,
yep,
moss here, search for it in our archive, and you can listen to that show. How about saltwater, he says?
I'd have to say the permit. I mean,
permit.
They're the hardest to fool, hardest to get to your fly, and then also they are one of the hardest fighting fish. They are really incredible how hard they pull.
And he says, looking for chances to catch extraordinary fish, how about species that run the farthest or jump the highest? He says, I'm looking to see if I'm overlooking something on my shorter list.
Well, I'll tell you that probably the longest run I've had of a fish in a couple of years was that 11-pound bonefish. The highest jumping fish that I remember recently would probably be, a golden dorado from down in Bolivia or payara in Venezuela. Those things, they skyrocket, and the tigerfish in Africa skyrocket as well. Just incredible.
Well, there's a few more for your list, Dino. And then lastly here, Kathy, again from Raleigh. She says, every angler has one landing that caused unparalleled joy. What is the single best catch that you will remember throughout your life?
Well, there's a few, but probably the one that was the hardest fight was getting my first golden moss here. And I caught it, the first big one I caught on a fly rod was on the Ram Ganga River in India with my now great friend, Misty Dillon. And that fish is absolutely extraordinary. And it took me a three-month trip with my wife trying to catch one on a fly rod where we didn't catch one, and I was never going to go moss here fishing again. And then I met Misty in the States. He invited me over, and after 3 or 4 days with Misty, I got that first golden muss here. And I'll never forget it. It was the hardest fish I ever had to work for to catch.
Wow. Okay. Good. Good. All right. Well, let's we got to wrap this up. We already run over, but another great show with you, Jeff. So hang tight with me. We're going to give away a few prizes, and so stick with me till the bitter end here, if you will. When we return here, we're going to give away a one-year membership to the Fly Fishers International and a one-year subscription to Drake Magazine, and also that one-year subscription to Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So hang with me here, and we'll be right back and do just that. The Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may be also at risk. The entire fly fishing industry is uniting this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining this fight. Be one of them. Visit SaveBristolBay.org to learn more about how you can get involved. Again, it's SaveBristolBay.org. Just a reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show. Says, what did you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave us your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now we're going to give away some prizes. The winners for the drawings are randomly selected from our show's registration database. And if you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show. You don't want to miss out on your chance on these incredible prizes we have to offer. If you are the lucky winner, we'll contact you after the show to provide you with information on how to receive your prize. So the first thing we'll give away is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. Definitely an organization like you'd like to be part of. So if you don't win tonight, go there and join up anyway, and it'll be well worth your time and money. So our winner for that is going to be Joshua Henshaw in California. Joshua Henshaw. So thanks for playing, Joshua, and congratulations on winning that one-year membership. Now we'll give away a one-year subscription to the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal, and you can learn more about that at amatobooks.com, a great publisher that has all kinds of books on fly fishing. So check them out, as well as some periodicals besides the Fly Fishing and Tying Journal. So amatobooks.com. And our winner there is going to be Sean Raines, Sean Raines in South Dakota. So congratulations to you, Sean. And Joshua and Sean, I know you're going to enjoy your prizes, and we'll get back to you after the show on how you can get me the information to collect those prizes. So thanks for playing. And now we'll give away that subscription, a one-year subscription to the Drake Magazine, courtesy of the Drake Magazine. And Drake is a grassroots journal for fly fishing enthusiasts, and really no matter where you live. It has stories and photos, freshwater, saltwater, and that'll entertain you for hours. If you want to check it out, it's drakemag.com. Again, drakemag.com. So we'll give that away here now. Let me just clear my queue. And the question to win the one-year subscription to the Drake Magazine is... there are three names that were used for the permit in St. Brandon's Atoll. Three names that were used tonight. What are the three names for that permit? This might be a little tough, Jeff, but we'll give it a shot.
Okay.
So start typing, folks. Let's get some answers in here, and we'll see if we can't get a winner. Meanwhile, I'm just checking
the view
here. No, I think we've mentioned that a bunch of times. So let's see if we get a taker here. Well, maybe it was too hard, Jeff.
Yeah, maybe two names.
Yeah, let's go down to two. We're going down to two, folks. Give me
the one that begins
names.
With S.
We've got we do have a winner. It's Doug McLean up in Calgary, Alberta. Snub-nose Pompano, yellow permit, and Indo-Pacific. So, good.
Nailed it.
I was beginning to wonder there. Lance came in second, but he got it all wrong. sorry, Lance. Sorry again, Lance. So, Doug, you won. Please send me your address and so forth. Again, you can put it in that same box or send it to info@askaboutflyfishing.com, and we'll get you. I'll need your name, address, and of course, I have your email address here, and we'll get you set up with that subscription. So, congratulations on all our winners tonight. We really appreciate it. And Jeff, thanks again so much for helping me out and being just a wonderful guest, full of information as usual. And also very entertaining and energy specific. So thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you, Roger.
Yeah, well, have a good summer and enjoy those nieces one more night. And I hope you get a good pizza up there.
I'm on my way. Thank you very much.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Hopefully all of you have found the archive in our website. If you haven't, there's a couple of links in it on our homepage and links at the bottom of every page. Check it out. We've got over 275 shows out there. Just about any keyword you type in, keyword phrase, trout, tarpon, Madison River, and now St. Brandon's, you're going to find a show. So check it out, and you'll be pleasantly surprised at all the information that's available to you. Our next broadcast will be on August 1st, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. That show, I'm going to interview Michael Gorman, and the topic for the show will be Nymphing to Catch More Fish. Michael, a professional and savvy guide, has vast knowledge on one of the most effective methods of catching fish, nymphing. His well-tested techniques are effective on both trout and steelhead, so join us to pick Michael's brain on all things nymphing. We would like to thank the Fly Fishers International, Motto Books, Drake Magazine, Whitbray Key Fishing Lodge, Watermaster, and Baja Fly Fishing Company for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing on the Net Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.